Good morning. Authorities say a man rammed a truck through a Mormon church in Michigan, shot and killed worshipers, and set the church on fire. What we know and reaction from Michigan Senator Alyssa Slotkin on Morning Edition from NPR News. As President Trump says a criminal investigation into George Soros is likely, we'll hear the first response from the Soros Foundation. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The head of the foundation says everything they do is legal and they're not afraid. Also, GOP strategist says Republicans in Congress are giving up too much power to the president. It's Monday, September 29th. Today in 1954, game one of the World Series, Willie Mays ran down a deep fly ball to center in the Polo Grounds to make an over-the-shoulder grab. The play is known simply as the catch. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump is expected to meet with top congressional leaders at the White House today. Lawmakers are facing a critical deadline on Tuesday to pass a temporary spending bill. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports if Congress fails to reach a bipartisan compromise, the government could partially shut down at midnight tomorrow.
The meeting is somewhat of a redo. Top Democrats were supposed to meet with President Trump last week to negotiate a path forward and avoid a shutdown, but the president canceled that meeting. The Oval Office meeting today will come hours before the Senate is expected to vote on a House-passed continuing resolution to fund the government through late November. Senate Democrats previously blocked that from advancing. They want to negotiate with Republicans to address expanded Affordable Care Act subsidies that expire at the end of the year. Republicans are pushing to pass the stopgap bill first and then negotiate. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump will host Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House today. NPR's Emily Fang reports the meeting comes amid increasing pressure to end the war in Gaza.
U.S. Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff told reporters that there might be a breakthrough on the plan in the coming days, but we reached out to Hamas negotiators who say they have not yet received any kind of written proposal of this plan. And so the question now is there enough pressure on the U.S. and Hamas, on Israel, to overcome fundamental disagreements which have sunk previous ceasefire proposals?
That's NPR's Emily Fang reporting from Tel Aviv. President Trump told Axios on Sunday that negotiations on a possible peace deal are at their final stages. Trump and Netanyahu are expected to hold a joint press conference at the White House following today's meeting. Authorities in Michigan say two bodies have been recovered from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Grand Blanc. They were among at least four people killed Sunday morning when a man drove his pickup truck into the building, then opened fire. Alex McLennan, a member station WDET, has more.
Law officials say Thomas Jacob Sanford, a 40-year-old military veteran, crashed his truck into the church before opening fire on the Mormon congregation and setting the building ablaze. Police neutralized Sanford shortly after in a church parking lot. FBI acting special agent in charge, Reuben Coleman, says the attack is being investigated as a targeted act of violence.
This act of violence has no place in our state or anywhere else in our country.
No motive for the attack has been given. Michigan police say they've responded to a number of bomb threats in the community following the Grand Blanc attack. For NPR News, I'm Alex McLennan in Detroit.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A new crime-fighting task force backed by local, federal, and National Guard troops is launching in Memphis this week. In a city known for both high crime and civil rights activism, residents and local leaders are divided over the deployment. Christopher Blank with member station WKNO reports.
For Rachel Spriggs and scores of activists who protested the task force over the weekend, federal help has a checkered history in this majority black city.
Because here help has meant harm.
Yes.
Here help has meant harassment.
Yes.
But many locals, including city council members such as Yolanda Cooper Sutton, say the tough measures are a consequence of previous failed crime interventions.
What are you going to do about it? What solutions do we have in place?
For Tennessee Governor Bill Lee, the solution is a surge of law enforcement from 13 federal agencies and state troopers. The National Guard, he said Friday, will neither be armed nor make arrests. It will work with Memphis police as the department focuses on violent crime. For NPR News, I'm Christopher Blank in Memphis.
Officials in Oregon are suing the Trump administration to block the deployment of National Guard troops to Portland. The state argues the president's description of the city as, quote, war-ravaged is pure fiction. Over the weekend, the Pentagon ordered 200 members of the National Guard into federal service, effective immediately for a 60-day deployment. Stocks close mixed across Asia today. Markets in China and Hong Kong posted gains, while shares fell sharply in Japan. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota history in 90 seconds.
September 1887, notices went out that Edwin Booth would be appearing at Duluth's Grand Opera House. He and fellow actor Lawrence Barrett would be performing favorite scenes from Shakespeare. But who was even thinking of Shakespeare?
God, how weary.
Because this was that Booth.
That an unprofitable scene to
the older brother of John Wilkes Booth, who a mere 22 years before had assassinated Abraham Lincoln at another theater, Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. Before the assassination, Edwin had been the most famous member in the Booth family of actors. But after, he became the brother of a president killer. Edwin had had to fight to get John Wilkes' body stored in a warehouse, returned to him in 1869, so he could bury him in an unmarked grave and get on with his own life again, running a theater company, and now in 1887, undertaking a multi-city theatrical tour. Duluth's audiences may have turned up out of curiosity, but they left with an appreciation for one of the era's greatest Shakespearean actors.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. The state of Oregon and the city of Portland are suing the Trump administration as President Trump moves to federalize hundreds of Oregon National Guard troops and send them into the city. We'll hear more about the latest American city targeted for military deployment in just a few minutes. But first,
a church service in Grand Blanc, Michigan, was violently interrupted Sunday morning after a man drove his truck into a Mormon church, fired at the people inside, and set the building on fire.
Authorities say four people from the church died and eight others are hospitalized. And a suspected gunman is also dead after exchanging fire with officers. An unknown number of people are unaccounted for as authorities search what remains of the church for additional victims.
Joined now by Michigan Public reporter Steve Carmody. Steve, what do we know about what happened?
Well, authorities say the attack began just before 10:30 yesterday morning when the suspect drove his truck through the front doors of the church as the service was underway. Hundreds of people were inside. Grand Blanc Township Police Chief William Rennie praised the bravery of the people as the gunman opened fire.
They were shielding the children who were also present within the church, moving them to safety. Just hundreds of people just practicing their faith.
As people fled, authorities say the suspect deliberately set the church on fire using gasoline. Two law enforcement officers arrived within a minute of the first 911 call and confronted the gunman outside the church, killing him about 8 minutes later.
Who is the suspected gunman?
He's been identified as 40-year-old Thomas Jacob Sanford. He lived in a small town about 20 minutes from the church. He's an ex-U.S. Marine. But we don't know yet about any possible motive for the attack or if he had any relationship with the church or anyone who was attending the Sunday morning church service.
Okay, now where's the investigation right now?
The FBI has taken charge of the investigation into the shooting and the suspected gunman. Reuben Coleman is the acting special agent in charge of the FBI Detroit field office.
This act of violence has no place in our state or anywhere else in our country. The FBI is committed to continue finding out the facts, circumstances, and motives behind this tragedy.
Now, we expect to learn more today about the victims of Sunday's attack and when the first funerals will be held.
Okay. Grand Blanc, Michigan is a small town, around 8,000 residents. It's 13 miles south of Flint, Michigan. How are the people there holding up?
Well, last night there were several places where people gathered for small vigils. A steady stream of people stopped by to pay their respects a short distance down the road from the church. Mother and daughter Cheryl and Haley Perkins lived nearby. They were just overwhelmed at what happened just down the street.
They just want to go to church. People just want to go to church in peace.
Now, others express shock. Scott Bennett is the Grand Blanc Township supervisor.
This kind of violence doesn't happen in our community, and we are heartbroken that it came to Grand Blanc Township.
Of course, that's the sentiment we often hear in each community where there's been a mass shooting in the United States.
That's Steve Carmody, a reporter with Michigan Public. Steve, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Senator Alyssa Slotkin, a Democrat, represents Michigan, where investigators are still searching the ruins of the burned church in Grand Blanc. Senator, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And if you could convey our condolences to all the people affected by this, we would appreciate it. How are people in Grand Blanc doing?
Well, I think, look, it's just extreme shock. This is the community just next door to the one I live in. It's a small community. It sees fender benders. It doesn't see this kind of violence. So you can imagine this kind of complex act that was literally designed to create terror. It was not just the shooting, it was the fire, and the community is just trying to understand what happened. It is a testament to law enforcement. I think I wish people could have seen what they did yesterday responding to the complexity of this attack. They're setting an example, I think, for all of us. They just put their heads down, got to work. There's plenty of time for us to figure out what happened and what the motive was for this man, but it doesn't matter at this point. These people are victims and they're survivors, and this community is going to have a long road back to healing.
So the FBI has taken over this case, and it says that the attack was an act of targeted violence. What does that mean?
Well, look, I mean, there was obviously premeditation. This man wanted to target this church, and he took a bunch of means to do it. His vehicle, he was the place on fire. He used an automatic or semi-automatic weapon to shoot people inside to create real fear. But we just don't know yet why. I think, we will find out in the next few days if there is even, I don't know what the justification could be, but I think the bigger picture here is just this epidemic of violence. I think we need to just grapple with the fact that we have people all over the country who are using violence as a way to convey how they feel, whether they're going through mental hardship or they've got an agenda, and it is just we have to grapple with it as a country.
I was going to ask you about that because we've seen, as I think everybody knows who's paying attention, we've seen a number of shootings recently. We've seen them in all different kinds of venues, at schools, at churches, including a church in Wayne, Michigan in June. You know, President Trump said that this appears to be a, quote, another attack on Christians, unquote. You just pointed out this is a complicated subject. We could spend the hour just talking about this. But what do you think needs to happen to keep things like this from happening again?
Well, I think we first need to acknowledge we have a problem. I mean, this is going on at a frequency that I think everyone is just astonished at. Acknowledging you have a problem is the first step to recovery. And then we have to understand we've clearly got mental health issues. We've got an issue, particularly with people across the country who feel like there's no threshold to violence, like it's an option for them. And then we have, of course, just a very easy access to guns. And for Michigan, we've had many shootings, in the past 4 or 5 years, high school shootings, college shootings, church shootings. It's all, to me, part of the same thing, that people have this, no threshold to violence. And we need to grapple with that both on law, but also just on support for people who clearly need help.
Hmm. So before we let you go, I did want to ask you about the spending bill. Republicans need the support of Senate Democrats in order to avoid a shutdown this week. Are you convinced that shutting the government down is the right approach here to force negotiations?
Well, look, I'm very happy that President Trump is meeting with congressional leadership today. That's a big step and important. You know, the Republicans have the White House, the House, and the Senate. So if they want to have a negotiation, they got to sit down and talk with people. And certainly for me, if you want to have a conversation about getting my vote, you need to talk about what has going on with health care right now. And between these cuts that they've put forward on healthcare and the fact that every single person listening is going to get a letter from their private employer insurance saying that rates are going up as of January 1st because of that. If you want my vote, you got to talk about healthcare.
20 seconds here. If you get the concessions that Democrats are seeking, do you trust that President Trump will honor the spending agreement?
Well, look, that depends on the agreement. The agreement's going to have to lock it down. He's not been living up to some of the commitments in the basic Constitution that the Congress appropriates the money and he then goes and funds the government. So it depends on the agreement, that's for sure.
That is Senator Alyssa Slotkin. She's a Democrat who represents Michigan. Senator, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Local leaders in Portland, Oregon, are suing President Trump to stop him from deploying the state's National Guard there. Portland is the latest city Trump has targeted for military action. As justification, his administration referenced protests outside a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility. Here's Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson.
The Trump administration called 200 members of the Oregon National Guard into federal service for a 60-day deployment. Hours later, the Oregon Department of Justice, the City of Portland, and Oregon Governor Tina Kotek announced a lawsuit, arguing the administration had overreached and acted unlawfully.
Putting our own military on our streets is an abuse of power and a disservice to our communities and our service members.
As recently as last week, President Trump called out Portland. His administration cited protests outside the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement building.
Portland is, I don't know how anybody lives there. It's amazing. But it's anarchy out there. That's
some Oregon Republicans, including U.S. Labor Secretary Lori Chavez-DeRemer, welcomed Trump's decision. Over the weekend, a former Oregon congresswoman called the city a, quote, crime-ridden war zone. Many other state and local officials have disputed Trump's framing, saying the president is relying on an outdated view of the city and may even be referencing videos from 2020 when the city saw months-long protests outside its federal courthouse. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson expressed dismay and disappointment over the Trump administration's decision.
We do not deny that Portland has hard and important work to do, and we've been doing it. To bring this narrative to Portland to say that we are anything but a city on the rise is counter to what truth is.
We have no choice, we have no fear.
We have no choice, we have no fear.
ICE is not welcome here.
ICE is not welcome here.
Over the weekend, news of the president sending troops to the city brought larger crowds outside the Portland ICE building. Catherine Holland says she's struck by the disconnect between what's happening in the city and the national rhetoric.
I wanted to see what was really happening. What I perceive was happening is there's just people protesting like they should be. No violence. And that's exactly what I've seen since I've been here.
Oregon officials say they'll file a restraining order, asking a federal judge to block the Trump administration's deployment. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
This is NPR News.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, we listen to this, Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations, we really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
And from Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Legacy Box, working to preserve family memories by converting tapes and photos to digital, offering cloud delivery to enable access from anywhere. More at LegacyBox.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The Trump administration is continuing to test how much power Congress is willing to hand over to the president. And last week, the Supreme Court gave the administration further permission to do so. Congress had approved $4 billion in foreign aid, but the court's conservative majority ruled that, for now, the Trump administration does not have to spend the money. It's a move called a pocket rescission. That's different from a normal rescission request, which must be approved by Congress. So now those previously appropriated funds will simply expire. So what's all of this mean for lawmakers trying to agree on a spending deal to avoid a government shutdown? That could be just a few days away. For this, we've called Brennan Buck. He's a GOP strategist who worked for two Republican House speakers. So, Brennan, what's this ruling from the Supreme Court mean for Congress's spending authority, at least for now, at least?
Well, I think it means it's up to them to stand up to themselves. The Supreme Court basically said the people who were suing over this just simply didn't have standing. They didn't rule on the merits. And ultimately, I think at this point, Congress needs to say, not only is it our constitutional responsibility to decide how spending is allocated, but these are laws. Congress has passed a law saying that this $4 billion needs to go to these purposes. And the president simply shouldn't have the authority to ignore that law. And that's what he's trying to do right now.
So with this spending deal that could lead to a government shutdown, say if Democrats sign off on particulars on a deal, what's to stop the president from another pocket rescission, especially since he seems to have the Supreme Court's backing?
Yeah, I think that's the stakes here. It's the precedent that they're setting here. This is a relatively small amount of money. But if the president is able to do this and establish that he put in one of these rescissions requests right at the end of the year, which is what they're doing right now, and trying to sort of game the calendar to say that Congress doesn't need to act, I don't think there's any question that he'll come back next year at the end of next fiscal year with a much larger package and basically point back to this precedent that they've set. So I think it is in the interest of not just Democrats, but Republicans as well, to protect their institution, include language in this funding package that simply says you can submit a rescissions request, but it needs to be done in a timely manner so that Congress has time to act on it. Because what he's trying to do right now is let the clock run out and just put up his hands and say, you guys didn't vote. I have no option but not to spend it.
How binding would that language be?
If it's put in law, I think it would be very clarifying. They're trying to use a loophole in what's called the Impoundment Control Act from 1974, which allows presidents to make requests to cancel funds, but they've always required Congress to vote affirmatively to back up that request. What they're doing now is using the end of the fiscal year. Congress has the deadline. Money can't be spent outside of the fiscal year that it's offered in. And so what they've done is put this request in right at the end of the fiscal year. If they clarify that the law says you can only put in these requests long enough ahead of a fiscal year that we have time to act, I think that would make the courts look at this very differently.
Even courts that are appointed by Donald Trump. I mean, he's got a bit of a majority in his favor.
They haven't even ruled on the merits on this, actually. And I have a sense that if the merits were considered, that he might lose. The challenge is that only one person has standing to sue in these court cases, and that's the GAO, head of the Government Accountability Office, and they haven't done that.
Now, you wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times spelling out how pocket rescissions could backfire on Republicans in the future. How so?
Absolutely. I mean, you should have some principle and interest in protecting your own institution. But if you're just looking at it selfishly, if you're a Republican and a future Democratic president comes in and says, well, we're just not going to spend money on, my examples are immigration enforcement or some military spending, I think you're probably going to look at this very differently. So it's not just this $4 or $5 billion in the short term. You've got to think about the long-term precedent that you're setting of how presidents can take away your power. Congress writes a law, says we're going to spend something, and just because there's this little quirk in this 1974 law that says they can request to get rid of it at the end of the year, and you just look the other way, I think that is really eroding their power, and they should think about not just what's right in front of them.
President's having some meetings with some members of Congress to kind of hash out this deal. About 20 seconds to go, Brendan. Is a shutdown inevitable at this point?
It sure feels like it. Republicans don't seem like they have any real reason to negotiate at this point because they seem to have the upper hand. And Democrats, I think, kind of feel like they need to show that they're willing to fight. So both sides will probably have a shutdown. I'm hoping it doesn't last very long, but that looks like where we're headed.
That's Republican strategist Brendan Buck. Brendan, thanks.
There's been a big shakeup in the race for New York City mayor. The current mayor, Eric Adams, dropped out Sunday, which could make things harder for Democratic frontrunner Zohran Mamdani. NPR's Brian Mann has this report.
In a video posted on social media, Adams said his reelection fight was crippled by media innuendo and unfair investigations, including by the city's campaign finance board, which last month voted to deny Adams matching funds. Adams said that made it impossible to keep going.
Despite all we've achieved, I cannot continue my reelection campaign.
Adams' administration was rocked by scandals, including federal bribery charges. That case was shelved under President Trump's Justice Department and dismissed by a federal judge. But support for Adams' reelection cratered. With Adams out, this race is one step closer to a head-to-head matchup between Zohran Mamdani, a state assemblyman and a relative newcomer to New York politics, and former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo resigned in 2021 following allegations of sexual misconduct, which he's denied. In his comeback bid, he's running as an independent, fighting to win over a big chunk of Adams voters by portraying Mamdani as inexperienced and a radical. We face destructive extremist forces that would devastate our city, Cuomo said in a statement Sunday, adding, quote, it's not too late to stop them. Mamdani is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, and if he wins, he'd be the city's first Muslim mayor. He fired back at Cuomo Sunday, saying New Yorkers shouldn't trade, quote, one disgraced corrupt politician for another. It's unclear whether the shakeup will slow Mamdani's steady lead in the race, fueled by young campaign volunteers and social media ads like this one, focused on affordability.
The cost of living is the real crisis. New Yorkers are being crushed by rent and childcare.
This is still a three-way contest. Republican Curtis Sliwa also faces pressure to drop out, including from President Trump, in order to set up a one-on-one race between Mamdani and Cuomo. Sliwa has said he's staying in through the November election. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News.
David McCloskey keeps writing spy thrillers, and the plots keep coming true. His latest book, The Persian, opens with an Israeli surprise attack on Iran.
Frankly, at times, I was tempted to tone it down so my editor wouldn't think I was making anything up that's too crazy.
The former CIA analyst on how the world's reality is often stranger than fiction on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXC with your local host, Heidi Holton. Good morning. It is 5:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Monday morning show. Coming up in a few moments, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this date, September 29th. Our weather for today, a warm start to the week, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 70s to low 80s, winds from the south 5 to 10 gusting higher, mostly cloudy overnight with lows in the upper 50s, and tomorrow partly sunny, highs in the mid 70s and breezy southeast winds. Support comes from Escape by the Lake on Paul Bunyan Drive in Bemidji, offering immersive themed experiences where teams work together to solve puzzles and find clues to escape within the hour. Learn more about the different themed rooms available at escapebythelake.com. The Range Area Walk to End Alzheimer's is this Sunday, October 5th at Minnesota Discovery Center in Chisholm. Registration begins at noon with the opening ceremony at 1 and the walk to follow. And the McCroskey Art Center in Grand Rapids hosts an opening reception for the new exhibit, Unearthed, this Friday from 4 to 7. It's a two-person mixed-media show developed from foraged objects. And the Virginia Public Library offers a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of the month at 4 p.m. Whether you are just starting out or fine-tuning your research, all are welcome. You can let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. You can also find events up north at kaxe.org, and we'll be looking at that in more detail coming up at 7:20. It is time for our daily dose of phenology. Here is John Latimer.
On today's date, September 29th, 2002, I had occasion to be mucking about in a bog and stumbled upon the bog birch. We are all familiar with paper birch, which is a very common tree of the uplands. We learned to recognize it at a very young age. The bog birch is equally common. It's in every bog that I've ever been in. Well, every bog that has the right chemical mix to the soil. The leaf itself on the bog birch is quite nicely roundly scalloped. I wouldn't call them teeth so much as scallops. And the leaves are small. The bog birch never grows much over 6 or 8 feet tall. And the leaves in the fall turn a remarkable red color. And they are just gorgeous this time of year. So if you are out, maybe you're a duck hunter and you get out into some of these areas, or maybe you just are out exploring, or maybe your deer stand requires you to cross a swamp. Whatever the case, if you're out this time of year and you're checking things out, look for those bright red scalloped leaves of the bog birch.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. And from Focus Features, presenting Anemone, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Two brothers wrestle with their past and the one secret that has kept them apart for decades. Anemone, rated R. In theaters Friday. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President Trump is talking about a criminal investigation of a liberal philanthropist. And today we have the first response from George Soros' foundation. Last week, as the Justice Department obeyed Trump's order to have a former FBI director indicted, Trump took a question about who he might like to prosecute next.
Because if you look at Soros, he's at the top of every... In fact, sometimes I say, could he be involved in this many things? But he's in every story that I read. Stories that I read keep talking about Soros. And I guess he'd be a likely candidate.
Soros is a big donor to Democrats. His Open Society foundations also support liberal causes. In the foundation's New York offices, its president, Benifer Novoroji, gave the organization's first interview since it became a target.
This is not about George Soros. This is about the United States slowly losing its democracy bit by bit in ways that we've seen elsewhere in the world.
How, if at all, are you preparing this organization for investigation or what you may see as attack?
So everything that we do is legal. Our activities are peaceful and lawful. Our grantees are required by the grant contract to abide by human rights principles and the law. So we have not done anything that we need to do differently, but we are getting ready for whatever is comes in by way of investigation or prosecution.
Her organization's founder is an immigrant and a Holocaust survivor and a billionaire financier and a philanthropist and an eternal character in right-wing conspiracy theories, as he once acknowledged in an interview on this program.
Because I consider myself mainstream American of Hungarian origin. But the way I'm depicted is some kind of an extremist that is a traitor to America and American values and so on, which is when I'm actually here to preserve those values.
That interview with me was 20 years ago, yet Soros's influence and his image remain little changed. In addition to his personal political donations, his foundations support activists, universities, and journalists around the world. The foundation's list of grant recipients include the American Civil Liberties Union, Arizona for Abortion Access, Amnesty International, and American University, and that's just a few of the A's. Further down the list is a grant 9 years ago to NPR, though we cover them like anybody else. At age 95, Soros has stepped back, but his son Alexander is the foundation's chairman as Navroji directs its operations. I think that people have used the label liberal for your work. Do you accept that label?
I stay away from those labels because I actually think a lot of our work is around civic engagement and ensuring that all people have the ability to engage in selecting their government or holding their government accountable. And as a result, we get accused of being opposition or trying to overthrow governments. And that's actually not at all what we're doing. What we're trying to do is ensure that all human beings, wherever they are, have the ability to access their rights.
The journalist Emily Tamkin wrote a book about the Soros foundations. She says Soros's critics play up the image of a globalist Jewish financier, blaming him for everything from illegal immigration to Black Lives Matter protests.
And it's true that you can find groups that have received money from Soros to participate in those protests, but that is very different from saying that Soros is the reason that people are out protesting on the streets, an allegation that overassigns agency to Soros and strips it from those groups.
As we talked, I read Tamkin a social media post from August by Donald Trump, which said Soros and his son should be prosecuted under a racketeering law.
Okay. First of all, Open Society does not support violence, but I even feel like spending time explaining that misses the point. The point is that the president is trying to expand the definition of terrorism, of national security threat, of crime, to include philanthropic or nonprofit organizations that he doesn't like because of the work that they do.
The group president, Benifer Novoroji, worked for Open Society for decades before becoming its president last year. And she says their situation feels familiar.
So I grew up in Kenya under dictatorship. And many of our staff in this organization have grown up in places and have ended up working for Open Society because they have experienced what the U.S. is beginning to experience. And it is not a good road to go down. And ultimately, it's a road to dictatorship and sometimes violence and injustice.
There's a conservative group that alleged that this foundation gave something like $2.3 million to a Palestinian human rights group called the Al-Haq Foundation. They say it is a group that has some kind of ties to a group that has been accused of terrorist activity. What is this group? Why do you fund them?
So Open Society Foundations funds human rights organizations around the world. And for the last 20 years, we have supported human rights organizations that are Israeli and human rights organizations that are Palestinian. Al-Haq is a human rights organization that documents violations that have occurred in the occupied territories and in Israel. The Israeli government designated them as a terrorist organization. But again, if you look at the work of Al-Haq, what does it do? It documents violations, human rights violations under the international human rights documents. And that itself is seen to be an act of terrorism in this day and age.
I want to ask particularly about your organization's experience in Hungary. It's a country where there is a populist right-wing leader, Viktor Orban, and many American conservatives look to him as a role model, as an example. What happened to the Open Society Foundation in Hungary in recent years?
So Open Society Foundations basically had been in Hungary, working in Hungary since 1984. And our support was to universities, independent universities, free media, libraries, scholarships. It was the opening up after the Iron Curtain came up. When Prime Minister Viktor Orban came in, who, by the way, is the recipient of a scholarship from Open Society Foundations, he basically adopted what we are seeing in the United States, which is this kind of us and them, an enemy. And he turned Open Society Foundation into a political target and vilified, in particular, George Soros, personally portraying him as an enemy of the state. You have to remember Soros is also Hungarian. What happened after that was that Orban began to close the civic space. So NGOs were prohibited from receiving foreign funding. The Stop Soros law began to criminalize support to refugees or migrants.
There was a law that was known as the Stop Soros law?
Yes. And then ultimately, OSF opted to leave the country. And I think you can see, you know, how universities become a threat, media becomes a threat, any other locus of debate or discussion becomes threatening to and is used to silence. Dissent has to be silenced.
Are you afraid?
No, we're not afraid. Open Society has seen this sort of phenomenon of political attacks against us in different parts of the world. We've stood up against that. We remain true to our values and to our mandate to promote rights and equity and justice. And so we will exercise all our rights in the courtroom and through the Constitution.
Benay Fornovrajee, thank you so much.
Thank you.
She's the head of the Open Society Foundations, started by George Soros, who President Trump named as a likely candidate for prosecution as he directs the Justice Department. This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 5:42. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. There is more ahead from Morning Edition. Coming up at 6:30, Minnesota Native News and Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. Support for KAXC comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. We also thank Edward Jones financial advisor Christina Gallus, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, member SIPC. Our weather for today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 70s to low 80s, winds from the south gusting up to 15 miles per hour. Mostly cloudy tonight, lows in the upper 50s, and tomorrow partly sunny, highs in the mid-70s, breezy southeast winds. United Way of Bemidji is collecting coats and other winter gear now until October 7th at Dress Club Cleaners and both Lucan's Village Foods locations. Items may be new or gently used. Distribution will take place Saturday, October 11th from 9 to noon at First Lutheran Church in Bemidji. The Rife Gallery in Grand Rapids has a reception for the exhibit And Plein Air, a group show from local outdoor painters. That's this Friday from 4 to 5:30. More news is next.
Da, 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 da. Bum,
start your day off on the right note with Morning Edition from NPR News. Listen every weekday.
Morning Edition begins at 5 a.m. Monday through Friday here on KAXE, people-powered radio for northern Minnesota. So many local conversations as well, like Area Voices and The Bright Spot and events up north and programs that have been around forever that you, too, can sing along to, like The Sports Page and What's for Breakfast. Thanks for keeping us here. Get us into the future with your donation now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Keep us humming along.
It don't matter if you tall.
Your NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. There's a new tropical storm churning through the Atlantic that's expected to become a hurricane. As the southeastern United States coastline keeps tracking Imelda, Asheville, North Carolina is looking back a year ago to Helene. In a town heavily reliant on tourism, businesses are still recovering and hoping for a big fall season. Here's Blue Ridge Public Radio's Laura Hackett.
This time last year, Brandon Davis had just opened the business of his dreams. The funky 70s-themed bar known as Day Trip sat near the banks of the French Broad River. Then floodwaters tore through the space.
Everything was covered in sewage from the ceiling to the floor. All of the antiques that I had been collecting and the vibe that I had curated, to see it all just covered in waste and dirt and mud, it was a big bummer.
It wasn't just businesses near the river. The storm ripped out the city's water main.
Our immediate concern wasn't the bar. Our immediate concern was we don't have food or internet or power. We have four cats and we have a dog. How do we get fresh water?
For weeks, people in Asheville were in survival mode. For Davis, it's now just a blur. His bar is back through a string of good luck, including a $200,000 GoFundMe campaign. He's managed to reopen at a new location, which he describes as being modeled after the living room of a grandmother who loves to party. On a Sunday evening, the colorful space is full of guests sipping on PBR and cucumber mezcal cocktails that are aptly named Everything in Its Right Place. It's a reassuring scene after a year of heartache. Still, Davis says he's nervous each month when rent comes due.
There are a lot of small businesses that have scraped everything they had and a ton of debt together to reopen, and we are dependent on tourism to keep us going and to get us out of the hole that we are in right now.
He says the city needs a really strong fall tourism season. Demand for vacation rentals has dropped by around 20% since Helene. Jay Slusher is a server at Golden Hour, a restaurant in the River Arts District of Asheville. He says after Helene, the job market was bleak.
There were times this winter where it really came home, where I felt lost. What am I going to do? Am I going to be able to survive here in Asheville? Will the jobs come back? Will the tourists come back? Moving did cross my mind.
There are thousands of hospitality workers in Asheville in the same boat as Slusher, making less money than last year and dealing with things like housing instability, insurance headaches, and mental health challenges. Kala Brooks, the manager of a craft cocktail bar named Top of the Monk, says it's been a time of reckoning for the industry.
The choice to stay or go has been so demanding and so challenging for so many people.
Over the past year, Brooks's staff has shrunk from 20 people to 4. And she had to shut down the brewery that was part of the cocktail bar. But in all of this uncertainty, she remains hopeful.
We lost a lot of really great qualified people in the service industry, but it's also like a period of rebirth and change.
And there are some signs of that happening. New restaurants are opening in vacant buildings around town, and the Blue Ridge Parkway has finally reopened. The mountain pass brings many tourists who love to see the fall leaves change color. For NPR News, I'm Laura Hackett in Asheville, North Carolina.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Well, I've got two brothers and they're in the Marines.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled and Lead urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
Climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high wear cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never
in oil country.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab knows that investors want control of their financial future. That's why when it comes to wealth management, Schwab is dedicated to giving investors more choices. More at schwab.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. Texas oil and gas firms are feeling pessimistic about the upcoming year. In the latest Dallas Fed survey, energy firms reported lower production, increased costs, and heightened uncertainty. Oil is, of course, a good chunk of the Texas economy, and the Texas economy is a good chunk of the U.S. economy, around 9%. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall has more on what it all means.
Typically, Kunal Patel with the Dallas Fed says oil and gas executives tend to look at the bright side.
And right now, they're pessimistic.
Some of their top concerns:
commodity prices, uncertainty, geopolitics.
Relatively weak oil prices is the big issue, with OPEC Plus raising production in an already amply supplied market. And tariffs aren't helping, says Carr Ingham with the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers.
There's just no denying that tariffs raise costs to the oil and gas industry. And there's no denying that that's happening in a year in which the price of the commodity that they sell is lower than it was last year.
The cost cutting has already begun for oil and gas firms and will likely continue, says Dan Pickering with Pickering Energy Partners.
We've seen layoffs. We'll probably see some more. I would say lower activity, ongoing consolidation, because the companies are looking for ways to gain efficiency, ways to gain size and scale.
But he's not betting against the state's oil producers either.
Net, 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 Texas is blessed and will continue to be.
The Permian Basin currently produces more oil than most countries. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Speaking of oil, BP has approved a $5 billion investment in a deepwater oil platform about 300 miles south of New Orleans. BP CEO has pledged to sell $20 billion in assets, including green energy projects, to finance the company's refocus on oil and gas. BP stock is about flat in pre-market trading. The auto parts manufacturer First Brands has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, got itself into this mess by borrowing too much, and the company's rapid fall has raised questions about the riskier side of lending in corporate America. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that.
First Brands is a conglomeration of companies acquired through loans. They make brake parts, windshield wipers, and water pumps. First Brands borrowed against its future revenues, promising to pay back investors when the money came in. This type of opaque borrowing doesn't show up on a company's balance sheet. First Brands tried to refinance its debt last month. The refinancing was put on pause after investors asked for an independent auditing of the company's accounts. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are all up in the 4 to 6/10% range, with Dow futures up 200 points. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.15%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager, designed to protect users needing access to secure logins for personal or work accounts from any device, anywhere. Bitwarden.com. And by Odoo, dedicated to providing software designed to scale with businesses. Odoo's programs for manufacturing, accounting, and more aim to provide building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
Back in March, and without warning, the Department of Agriculture terminated a program that helped schools buy locally grown food for student meals. Now, the department is bringing it back with revisions for next year, technically the fiscal year, which starts in October. In the past, schools used this program to get anything from local ground beef for patties to fresh veggies for the salad bar. But farmers and school districts could be hesitant to participate this time around. Marketplace's Savannah Peters has more.
On Buffalo Creek Ranch in Moriarty, New Mexico.
Let's walk through here real quick.
A couple of Angus cows and their calves are munching on hay.
We're 13th generation New Mexicans. We've been ranching, you know, as a business for the last 5 to 6 generations.
Manny Encinias and his family market their beef locally to restaurants and at farmers markets. But a few years ago, Encinias says school districts joined his customer base with funding from the USDA.
That was a game changer, right? I think for us, that's given us market access during the fall and the wintertime.
When Encinias says direct-to-consumer sales tend to slow down, he gradually scaled up to supply that new market. But when the funding was canceled, so were a lot of his contracts.
I mean, the rug's been pulled out from underneath us.
Encinias had to break from his usual business model and auction off some of his cow-calf pairs. That meant he got a smaller return than he was expecting through contracts with the schools.
It's probably going to cost us anywhere in the neighborhood of $50,000 to $85,000. And I think that's pretty sizable.
This is how a lot of small-scale farmers spent their summer, looking for new buyers for food that was supposed to feed local kids. At the same time, schools scrambled to fill holes in their menus.
Two of the hardest jobs you can have in this world are like farmer and school food provider.
Sunny Baker with the National Farm to School Network says school districts are getting squeezed by multiple federal cuts, plus higher food prices across the board.
They're often going back to highly processed foods to just get the kids simply fed.
The USDA's revived Farm to School grant program comes with a higher funding cap and looser guidelines for which local producers schools can buy from. But Jennifer Gaddis, a professor at the University of Wisconsin, says it may be too late to restore some farm-to-school partnerships.
I think it just left a lot of people feeling kind of burned that they had spent a lot of people hours trying to start something new in terms of these new relationships, these new supply chains.
In New Mexico, Manny Encinias is willing to give it another go if local school districts are.
Let's just get the food back into the hands that need it.
But Encinias builds his herds and makes business plans a year or more in advance. If those markets are coming back, he needed to know yesterday. In Moriarty, New Mexico, I'm Savannah Peters for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Good morning. It's a minute before 6 o'clock. You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. There are lots of local news stories and conversations for you to check out, and you can click on the donate button and support this independent local media. Thanks so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. We'll have more ahead from Morning Edition from National Public Radio. Coming up at 6:30, Minnesota Native News and Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. A warm start to our week. Mostly sunny today. Highs in the upper 70s to low 80s. South winds 5 to 10, gusting higher. And tonight, mostly cloudy. Lows in the upper 50s. For tomorrow, partly